Up next, we have our keynote from Micah Heilbronn. So Micah is a brand new professor, assistant professor. Let me get on to my slideshow there. It's brand new assistant professor of cognitive AI at the University of Amsterdam, and is interested in how brains and artificial systems understand language and make sense of the world. He was trained at the Donders Institute and the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics under the supervision of two highly regarded scientists, Floris de Lange and Peter Haggart, and wrote a provocatively titled thesis, at least I think, maybe not so much provocative, but interesting. Which is here. I like the idea of the bi-directional window into things. So I wanted to put that up on the screen. Micah also published one of my lab's favorite, or at least Ed's lab's favorite papers last year. And not just because they analyzed some of our lab's data, which happens to be available on the CNSP website. But in this paper, he analyzed word-level predictions from a large language model and showed multiple hierarchical predictions. So maybe getting at some of those questions that were asked in the end there, that were dissociated in neural activity, which we just thought was really exciting that he could pull that out of our data and some other data. So I'm really excited to introduce our early career keynote to be given by Micah Heilbronn. So join us in welcoming him.
All right. So if everything should be working, you should be able to see my slides now. Is that correct?
See your slides and hear you.
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Well, thanks for the very kind introduction and for the invitation, of course. It's an honor and it's a lot of fun to be here. It's also really nice and cool speaking just after Marlies, because our work is very similar in some ways, at least to some of what I will be presenting. But I'll be coming from a pretty different theoretical background, but the methods are in many aspects quite similar. So I guess that's also very nice and pedagogical for all the attendees. They can see very similar ways of working and drawing quite different conclusions or learning different aspects of the same types of analyses. All right. So today what I want to talk about is a sort of more high-level framework for studying the brain and how we can use both the types of naturalistic data analyses that we are discussing in these 2 days, and modern AI developments, and how we can combine them. So now I hope that my clicker will work. All right, cool. So the theoretical backdrop here is the idea of the predictive brain. And the predictive brain is this sort of very high-level term for a family of models and theories, really. That all revolve around the idea that the brain, neural processing in the brain relies on continuous prediction. And mechanistically, this is formalized in most detail in vision, in particular around mechanistic ideas like predictive coding. And here it's typically formalized as this bidirectional processing cascade, where the feed-forward component works something akin to a ConvNet in the sense that it extracts increasingly abstract features. And this is then complemented by a top-down component, which conveys predictions from a generative model. And so these predictions are constantly compared to what is coming in. And by making this comparison, the brain computes a prediction error, which is used both for inference at short timescales to try to make sense of what is out there, and at longer timescales to learn, to perform self-supervised learning. And importantly, this is postulated to be a canonical cortical computation, which is, I guess, a fancy way of saying that it's something really quite general and something fundamental and something that is found all over the brain. So this should be a fundamental principle that applies not just to vision, but also to hearing and to language and what have you. Now, there is quite some evidence that is in line with this idea. And that has made the framework pretty influential over the past years. So for instance, in the domain of visual perception, a very influential set of paradigms is, for instance, statistical learning. So participants would then be exposed over and over to one stimulus predicting another stimulus, such as here, a jukebox predicting a clock. And what is observed is that as participants are exposed to these regularities, so jukebox clock, jukebox clock, jukebox clock, over and over, as one stimulus becomes predictable, so hit the clock, you see that the brain responds differently, much more weakly than if it's unpredictable. And you see this in many domains. So for instance, in language, Marlies already referred to the N400. So when a sentence ends expectedly, so I drink my coffee with cream and sugar, the brain responds very differently and much more weakly than if the sentence ends unexpectedly, like I drink my coffee with cream and dog. Right. So time and again, in all these domains, what all these types of evidence seem to point to is this predictive brain idea, where the brain is seemingly constantly comparing what is coming in to its own expectations. Now, all this foundational work using, let's say, classical cogneuro methods is, of course, very important, and it has taught us a lot. And it's the reason that I got interested in the predictive brain in the first place. But there are some limitations of this sort of classical approach. And the first is generalization. So while we now know very well that the brain indeed starts predicting in these specific paradigms, like jukebox clock, jukebox clock, what is not so clear is whether the findings in those jukebox clock scenarios would also generalize to perception more broadly. And this is actually very important for the predictive brain, because for the predictive brain, the idea is not that the brain can predict, but that it always does. Right, so does it also apply to a more naturalistic scenario, like when you're listening to music or you're watching movies, or perhaps you're just seeing complex images? And the second question is, what is meant by a prediction? Because this predictive brain theory is a very general theory. So according to the predictive brain, a prediction can be anything. So if you're predicting a clock, for instance, you might predict some high-level idea or some visual prototype, or perhaps even the very specific low-level features of that exact clock. Now, of course, neurally, these different options, these different scenarios would imply a very different neural mechanism. But it's often not so clear in these sort of classical methods what types of predictions are manipulated and therefore what is going on. Now, there are two recent sort of developments in neuroscience and AI machine learning that allow addressing both these issues. And the first is the rise of generative AI. So for a long time, this notion of a generative model that predictive brain theories talked about was quite elusive. And people could write down the equations, and it was formulated in a Bayesian brain framework, but no one could actually implement the types of predictions that we thought the brain would be making. And this is now changing, since generative models are actually working. So for instance, in language, one sort of very striking example is GPT-4 and all other sort of more sophisticated generative models. So these are models that can predict stimuli, and you can, and then they can generate text, for instance. It, the same is true for videos. So they predict video frames and they could generate a video. Now, the second development is sort of the rise of neural data science and open science more broadly. So we now have these large data sets of very high quality naturalistic images of naturalistic stimuli. That is both sort of in the mouse or rodents, like invasive electrophysiology, and also the types of data sets we've been talking about today. So what I've been doing is sort of combining these two trends, and then I call it the generative AI framework for studying the predictive brain. So how does that work? So instead of, the setup in general is quite simple. You start with a stimulus, often a naturalistic stimulus, so not a jukebox clock stimulus, but for instance, in language, could be an audiobook or natural music or simply natural images. And these are simply shown to the brain, and the brain activity is recorded. Now, at the same time, the same naturalistic images are analyzed with a neural network, and then specifically a generative model. So a model that can predict, for instance, the next word, or it can predict the next note in music. And then these predictions can be compared to the actual stimuli to compute the predictability. And then we perform a regression to test if indeed the brain response is different when the stimulus is predictable versus unpredictable. And this regression can be depending on the situation. So if it's a time continuous naturalistic stimulus, you would need deconvolution approaches like implemented in the MTRF toolbox. It can also be a non-deconvolution if there's no temporal overlap. But the important aspect is that it's a multiple regression approach. So we can include all the baseline variables, like Marlies already talked about, such as acoustics or envision, can be local contrast. And on top of that, we add the expectedness estimates to test if the brain responds differently to unexpectedness while controlling for low-level confidence. Now, this has two sort of main advantages. And the first is generalization, right? So we can move beyond the jukebox clock scenario and test if, even when you're simply watching a movie, if the brain responds differently when a stimulus is predictable. And the second, perhaps more interesting aspect, is that because we model the predictions instead of manipulating them, you can make the concept of prediction as precise as you want. So you can, for instance, compute the overall predictability of a word, but you can also separately model the predictability at different levels of abstraction, like the predictability of the meaning or the predictability of the exact sound and so on. So here you're only limited by your own modeling skills and imagination, and you can make this concept of prediction arbitrarily precise. So you can have, as I like to call it, you can have an unlimited conceptual resolution. So if we're using really powerful and beautiful open data sets, we have very nice temporal resolution, very nice spatial resolution, and only limited by your own modeling, you can have very strong conceptual resolution. All right, so that's still very high level. Now, the first sort of study where I was approaching this framework and I've worked it out in detail was a study for my PhD, which was on language. And here we analyzed people listening to audiobooks, and one of the data sets was actually the data set recorded by, I think, Giovanni, and it was graciously shared by the Lalore Lab. And another data set is an EEG, the MEG data set that we recorded ourselves at the Donders. And to model the predictions, we use GPT-2, which is this large generative model which can predict the upcoming word. Now, from GPT-2, what you get are the high-level predictabilities of words. So, for instance, this is one of the sentences from one of the audiobooks. It made the boy sad too. And then what you get from the model is a probability distribution over every potential next word. And what we came up with in this paper was a method to then disentangle this overall prediction into different levels of prediction. So, for instance, how did that work? You can see here that it made the boy start to think, to see, to know, to hear, to say, to be. If you analyze all these predictions, you see, even though GPT-2 is not exactly sure about the identity of the next word, all these are verbs. So it's pretty damn sure that the next word will be a verb. You can do the same for semantics and for speech sounds. So you can compute not just how predictable a word is overall, but also at what level. So syntactically, lexically, or phonologically. So the striking thing of this paper was that we found that the brain responds not just to word unexpectedness, but it responds differently to each type of unexpectedness. So here you can see the TRFs. And you see that, for instance, the syntactic predictability leads to a very early frontal effect, whereas semantic predictability results in a much later and spatially much more distributed effect. Whereas phonological or phoneme predictability leads to this early effect. And here I'm showing the TRFs, but we also did an analysis like Marlies described, where you look at if the model, if each of these variables explains unique cross-validated variants over and above the baseline variables. And so we found independent, dissociable, and sort of unique contributions of predictions at each level of abstraction. So given that it seems that when you simply listen to speech, the brain predicts at multiple levels of abstraction, the next question we asked was, how do different levels interact? And we already touched on this a bit during the Q&A with Marlies. But one way to look at that is to look at different ways of doing phoneme prediction. So normally how this works, phoneme predictions are sort of formalized via the idea of incremental word recognition. So as phonemes come in, the cohort of potential lexical candidates that are consistent with the phonemes so far shrinks until the word is incrementally recognized. And you can cast this as a process of probabilistic phoneme prediction by grouping each of the candidate's next words by their identifying next phoneme. So fact, family, fat would be false, for, fortunate would be all, figure, finish, fisherman would be etc. If you then attach a weight to each of these candidates, you can do the math and derive a probability distribution over phonemes for each phoneme. Now, there are two ways of assigning the weight. And one way is to use this simple the lexical frequency or the unigram probability. So here you would take the probability of an overall word overall in English. So for instance, the word for is very frequent. So we would have a very high a priori likelihood. And the overall probability for the next phoneme is then highly biased by these high frequency words. Now, alternative possibility is that it's the weight is not determined by the overall word probability or word frequency, but by the contextual probability that we take from GPT-2. And here the distribution would be quite different because if we look at this context, they say his father was a. The word for, even though it's very high frequency, is not very likely because it wouldn't be even grammatical. They say his father was a four. Whereas fisherman, even though overall it's a very unlikely word, in this context, it's very likely because this is from The Old Man and the Sea. I don't know if you've read it, but it's all about fishing and fishermen. So GPT-2 understood that and knew that it was indeed very likely. So the overall probability distribution looks very different. Now, importantly, while this frequency model is a single level model in the sense that it uses a short sequences of context, so short within word sequences of phonemes, as a context plus a fixed prior, namely the overall probability of each word in the English language. The contextual model is hierarchical in the sense that you use not just short intra-word frequencies of prior phonemes, but the prediction is also based on the longer sequences of prior words. So it's hierarchical in this way, the concept of hierarchical graphical models in Bayesian inference. For instance, you use two levels of context. And so what we did is we compared the sort of cross-validated prediction performance of both models and compared it to the baseline model. And what we found both in the EEG and in the MEG participants that the models that include word phoneme unexpectedness work better than the baseline, but the models that include hierarchical unexpectedness work better still. And this is indeed very much in line with the sort of concurrent paper from Christian Brodbeck, where they actually found, they asked a different question, and they found that the single level and the hierarchical model seemed to work in parallel. So we did a very rough, is one better than the other analysis, and it seems that the brain indeed performs hierarchical computation, but it may also perform single level computation. So the story may be a bit more subtle there. But overall, what we found in language is that when people listen to natural language, the brain constantly predicts. It predicts at multiple levels of abstraction, and we find this very suggestive evidence that at least in the domain of phonemes, higher level context can inform lower level context, which is exactly what you would expect from this predictive brain idea. And with a master's student, we performed a similar study in music. So the setup was quite similar. We again did one MEG study at the Donders and graciously thankfully used the data set provided by Giovanni, which is EEG. And the setup was again similar. So people listened to MIDI, which is converted to audio. And then at the same time, we have a transformer, very similar to GPT-2, which analyzes the MIDI. And then we ask if the brain responses to the musical notes, so not words, but here musical notes, are different as a function of the unexpectedness of the musical notes. And again, we found, as well as in the MEG, EEG, as in the MEG data, we find these characteristic TRFs, and we find that the brain response is indeed modulated by the unexpectedness of the tone. Also similar to what Giovanni and others found. The twist of this study was not the TRF itself, but was what type of information is used in the prediction. So here we use not just one neural network, but we use actually many neural networks, which each use a different amount of context. And what we found first is that the neural network that used the most context could predict the music best. And this is not surprising, but it was an important sanity check. So the more information we gave to the transformer, the better it became at predicting the next node. But when we did the same analysis for the delta, for the not the ability to predict the music, but the ability to predict the brain using the unexpectedness of the music, we found a very different curve. So here we found that the models that best predict the musical surprisal response was actually not the model that used the most context, but that used one of the fewest contexts. So a context window of maybe only 5 to 10 words. So this is a very short, just a few seconds, just one or two musical motifs. So contrary to language, what we found is that the musical surprise response actually seems to reflect very low level in the sense of short range acoustic predictions. And yeah, this study was, by the way, very much spearheaded by Pius, who is now starting a PhD, and I wanted to mention him specifically. All right. So in the last study I wanted to highlight, I want to take this idea to the visual domain. And here it's just the visual perception of naturalistic images. And here the situation is quite different, because when you simply see a natural scene, a complex image like this, there's no temporal prediction. However, one form of prediction that might be there and that is very important in sort of classical predictive coding theories is spatial prediction or pattern completion. Now, pattern completion is pretty easy to think about in very extreme cases, like a checkerboard, where if you perceive only a small part of the stimulus, you can perfectly pattern complete and predict the rest. But how can you probe this in more naturalistic images? Now, here we took an idea inspired by a paper from last year from Neuron, which is a very nice paper. And the key idea is that it relies on receptive fields. So just to make sure that everyone understands what I mean by that, the visual cortex is sensitive to only these small apertures, small parts of the visual world. And if you have a data set where you know the receptive field for each voxel or for each neuron, like in the Allen Institute's visual coding data set of the mouse visual cortex, what you can do is that you can take out, you can mask out the receptive field from the perceived image. Take a generative model that is trained for filling in, for inpainting, for reconstructing, to reconstruct and to predict the content of the receptive field, and then compare the predicted receptive field to the actual receptive field to compute the visual predictability. And then you regress that again on the brain response while taking into account low-level visual information like the acoustic the visual contrast. Now, importantly, like before, you can compute not just the overall predictability, but you can compute this predictability at multiple levels of abstraction. So if you take your actual receptive field patch and your predicted receptive field patch, what you can do is extract a hierarchy of features. Here we did that with a convolutional neural network. You could theoretically also use something else. And in CNN, the early layers extract simple patterns like edges and lines, whereas later layers extract things like textures and object parts, so more high-level features. And if you do the comparison at each level, you can compute not just how unexpected or how unpredictable the visual information is overall, but also at what level of abstraction, like at the level of simple edges or textures or shapes, etc. And so just to make sure that you understand what's going on, the data set here is a data set of mice viewing these large full-field images all for 250 milliseconds at the same time. And each image is repeated 50 times in total. It's like 6,000 trials, and you have thousands of neurons. All right, so if we look at V1, the average response looks like this. It's the blue line. We see that when a natural image comes online, the firing rate starts to peak. And so the red line here is sort of analogous to the TRF, although we didn't use a TRF method, but just linear regression. But it's the effect of the average response to a natural image plus one SD of the unpredictability. And just for comparison, the gray line here is the effect of the average response plus that of local contrast in the preferred spatial orientation and spatial frequency. So what is quite interesting is you can see that unpredictability modulates the response, but it modulates the response only later in line with the more recurrent process, whereas a low-level contrast modulates the immediate feed-forward sweep, and it has also a stronger effect. Now, if you do that for each convolutional layer, so for each level of abstraction, you see that overall, each layer seems sort of the unexpectedness of each convolutional layer modulates the brain response, but especially the highest convolutional layers. So if we now summarize over time and look at the effect of the level of abstraction in terms of their effect size, what we find is that indeed, the later layers of AlexNet have the largest effect. And if you're a vision scientist, you may now be a bit puzzled, because this is indeed this is V1. So we see that the most abstract feature on predictability has the largest effect. We know from V1 that V1 itself is sensitive to low-level features. So indeed, if you do the classical sort of DiCarlo encoding approach, so we're not thinking about unpredictability now, but just the sensitivity to the visual features, we see exactly the opposite curve. So V1 neural responses are best predicted by low-level features, but high-level unpredictability. So you see exactly the opposite tuning, which is kind of interesting. Oh yeah, and then sort of as a last tidbit, all this work, by the way, is still very much in progress. So it may still change a bit as we do some additional analyses. But one thing that I didn't want to ignore today is the laminar analysis. So in this data set, the mice have these neural pixels probes in their visual cortex, and they measure not just at one cortical location, but they measure all throughout the cortex. So what you can do is look up for every unit that you record where they are in cortex, and then sort of very roughly subdivide them into superficial or deep cortical layers. And if you do that, you find that the effect is much stronger in the neurons that are classified as superficial than those in deep. But this is only for the feature unpredictability. We don't find this for contrast. So it seems that this unpredictability effect is not just tuned inversely to what you might expect from V1, but it's also strongest for the superficial layers compared to the deep, which is exactly in line with many of these theories about the predictive brain. All right. So if we come back to our question, so generalization, do we find that indeed the brain always predicts? So what these studies so far show, including others, is that in language, yes, in music, yes, in vision, yes, we find predictability effects and continuous prediction in all these domains. And if we then ask the second question, what is actually in this prediction? We see that in language, we find this hierarchy of predictions, where the brain is constantly predicting at multiple levels of abstraction, and higher levels seem to be able to inform lower level predictions. Whereas in music, we find strikingly low level in the sense of short range predictions. And then finally in vision, we find these higher level predictions that are then fed back to V1. Although I have to say that, yeah, this vision project is still work in progress, that the exact conclusions may still change. All right. So summing up, the rise of generative AI enables stronger and more precise tests of the predictive brain hypothesis. They so far reveal ubiquitous prediction in many domains and across levels of representation. And to me, at least, this really showcases the power of AI to change the way we do cognitive neuroscience. And yeah, well, the last point is just it's my own personal view, but I think this is really the future for the study of the predictive brain. So with that, I just wanted to thank you, of course, for your attention and all my co-authors, and especially the people who provided all the open source software and data, with a special mention here to Giovanni and the Lower Lab more generally, because without you, it wouldn't have been possible what I've been doing over the past years. So with that, thank you very much.
Well, cool talk. Really liked it. I'll anyone have any questions?
Should I stop sharing or?
No, you can keep it up in case you have slides that could possibly answer questions.
That's true. Yeah.
So we have one for one of the attendees. I'll We'll let attendees ask questions first, and then, you know, I have a question, Giovanni has a question. So if there's no questions, we'll ask some questions. But there's an attendee who has a question. Feel free to unmute if you'd like.
So I have a question about the language model.
Yeah.
So you talked about how, I mean, I know you used it as an example, but in the Old Man and the Sea example, it sort of used the context. I'm assuming, I don't know so much about the GPT models, but I'm assuming it uses context that it finds online to sort of make the predictions. Is that a correct assumption?
Yeah, definitely.
So would then understanding the human brain, like, wouldn't that be a big jump? Because the human brain doesn't have all of the information that, like, the model would have. So, like, context clues would be more in terms of, like, the meaning of the sentence. But then when you look at context clues that include all of the literature, you know, ever written, wouldn't that be, like, a not equal comparison?
Yeah. No, I'm really happy you asked this question because it's, I first had a slide on sort of clarifications and common objections, but I removed it for the sake of time. But one of these things, it was actually really happy you asked because it's a question that comes up a lot. So in this approach where you use a generative model to quantify the statistics that you hope, that you assume that the brain is tracking, it doesn't require assuming that the exact statistics computed by GPT are exactly what is tracked by the brain. And what I often do is make a comparison to something like how we compute word frequency, for instance. So for word frequency, we often have these algorithms that we count the word occurrences in a huge corpora, and they are often much larger than what you read in your entire lifetime. But so this is not meant to be an exact statistic of what you exactly have in mind. But what people tend to find is that the better you objectively approximate this statistic, on average, the better that you would track the specific predictions in the brain. And that's also what you find in language. So Marlies mentioned before that she couldn't really find significant effects, differences between different models, like an RNN and an N-gram. But in reading time, in the reading time literature, people have done this a lot. And what people always find is that the better the language model becomes, so going from an N-gram via an RNN, via simple transformers up to like GPT, there's this monotonic, almost linear relationship between the quality of the language model and the quality of the fit. And that's probably not because the human brain is exactly making that prediction. Probably the human brain is doing something less sophisticated. It has also read less and learned less. But the more it matches the objective statistics, the more on average it will be closer to the idiosyncratic statistics of individual participants. So that was a long-winded explanation, but I hope it makes it clear.
Yeah, it makes more sense. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Mike. This is Ed Lawler here. I had a question on if I just trying to understand the you had a kind of an X shape for these predictions versus low level contrast that the V1 was sensitive to. Is that right?
Yeah.
So I'm maybe you could just talk us through that again, because I was trying to understand how what V1 might care about in terms of low level features.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I think about predictive coding theories, surely it should be getting predictions that are of predicted low level features. So, my misunderstanding, maybe you could talk me through this curve again.
No, you didn't misunderstand it at all. And it is also surprising. And it's also what I expected, even though this particular neuron paper already pointed a bit in this direction. Mm-hmm. It was also what I expected. So, I was expecting to find that early visual cortex is sensitive to predictability of low-level features, whereas later visual cortex would be sensitive to the predictability of high-level features.
Mm-hmm.
And that would indeed be in line with a very strict or sort of cartoonish view of predictive coding. But what we find is the opposite. So I think you understood it perfectly. We find this inverted tuning functions where, in terms of the low-level features, V1 is indeed sensitive to the lowest levels of here you quantify it via the encoding performance of AlexNet. But in terms of the unpredictability, it's exactly the other way around. And yeah, I can speculate why that may be. But in terms of if you've understood it correctly, I think you understood it perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, thanks.
Now, yeah, if there's not another question, I can also speculate a bit why this may be the case. One thing that I find myself especially interesting is that there are now results in machine learning where people are impressed by sort of the performance of GPT, for instance, and they think, okay, if we can learn everything there is about language just from predicting words, can we also learn everything there is to learn about vision just from predicting pixels? So they've trained these large models to predict pixels based on their curves. And what they find is actually that models that become really good at predicting pixels are really not so useful for high-level visual tasks. And the only methods that work really well in terms of this self-supervised pre-training are methods that explicitly, in some way or another, discourage the prediction of low-level features and encourage the prediction of high-level features. So what you see from machine learning is that the thing that's really useful in self-supervised pre-training is prediction of high-level features. And then what we see in the brain is that the thing that really drives early visual cortex is the predictability of high-level visual features. So that's, to me at least, a striking parallel. And to me, what that may suggest is that this may reflect a learning signal, which we know from machine learning to work really well. But that's, of course, speculation. You could also come up with other explanations, but it's my pet theory for why we may find this opposite tuning.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Thank you.
Joe, did you want to ask a question or should I?
Yeah, I have a quick one, Aaron.
Go for it.
Music hierarchy. Have you tried to look into, you know, your second point in the conclusions was that, yeah, there is the hierarchy in speech, but in music, you find this slow, small, you know, short context to be the optimal. But have you tried to combine short, long context?
No. The answer is no. I also really wouldn't know how you can do that. Actually, this is why I like working with language so much, because we have this large inventory and we know that sort of words exist, at least if you believe words exist in the mind. And we have syllables and phonemes, and we can really dissect stimuli at these multiple levels and then explicitly look how one level informs the other. I wouldn't really know. So I know what a note is, but I don't have the conceptual apparatus to know what a word would be in music. So we could, I wasn't smart enough, let's put it like that, to perform the same types of analysis. But what do you think? How can you test this in music? What is the right level of granularity?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking, I mean, from a purely methodological point of view, you could have multiple features fit with different context lengths. That's a boring thing. The other thing is inspired from what Ed said to me years ago on classical music, that the first time you listen to it, maybe you just focus on the on patterns that are short term, and then you start getting the you know, different levels of context. And so maybe modulating that on the participant, getting multiple repetitions of complex patterns and see whether that curve that you have there changes, you know, having the same identical method you have there but with different conditions or different
that's true. It would require, we wouldn't be able to use your download, your data, and use such an open-ended data set. But indeed, yeah, I agree. With sort of very clever experimental design, I think you can go there. And what did you mean with the first boring one? You meant like a decoding analysis and then sort of comparing the decoding performance on a time-resolved basis and relating that to expectedness or something? Or?
Yeah. Sorry, Aaron, this is not as quick as I thought. I meant a bit like what you do in language, where you include multiple features, multiple surprise vectors that were fit using different context lengths. You know what I mean?
Right.
You could either simply use that model and have different context lengths.
If they're independent of each other.
Sorry? They could be both. Right. It just, maybe that's not, maybe not with that model. I don't know. Maybe the other models.
Yeah. Yeah, who knows? I don't know. I do like this effect because initially Pius came up with the idea. And I was like, are you sure, Pius? Because I think the better the model is, the better it will fit the brain. Do you think we can have an interesting effect? And then Pius like said, well, we don't know, blah, blah, blah. And then we did it and we found this really striking dissociation and I never thought we would have. So, yeah.
Cool. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.